Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting but not video streaming today from our studios in New York City. We're going to have the latest on how drinking hot tea every day is linked to a lower glaucoma risk, Brown University as well as UCLA. And we're going to look at how soy and cruciferous vegetables are associated with fewer common breast cancer treatment side effects, Georgetown University Medical Center, and how the omega-3 fatty acids impact your brain and prevent neurodegenerative disease, Laval University, and a whole lot more on health and healing. Also today, the latest on environmental issues. I'm going to be accelerating information on the environment because it's our greatest single crisis in the world today, except for the possibility of nuclear proliferation. But nuclear proliferation is something we can negotiate, we can prevent. But global warming, we cannot prevent. It's tipped. In fact, of the 40 tipping points, half have tipped. Now, some have a delayed reaction. It might be 10, 20 years before we see the full impact. But those are going to happen no matter what. And yet we're told that we cannot exceed 2 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. We're already at 1.6, and it will pass that in the near future. So virtually all, every single mathematical model of how bad it's getting was grossly understated. And I'll get to that today. And on Monday's show, a full hour explaining what's going on with our environment in detail. It'll be a very comprehensive program. You won't want to miss that. Today also some commentaries. I was asked last night as I was exiting a movie theater, someone who came over and said he listens to the show. And he said, I don't hear you talking about democracy. And I turned to him and I said, because we have no democracy. And the person says, yes, we do. I said, well, I hold a different opinion. The United States is not a democracy. And more importantly, it has never been a democracy. He said, well, could you explain yourself? And I said, well, I've got people to counsel now, so I don't have time, but listen to my show tomorrow. So today, I will share an in-depth understanding, or at least enough to get you started, and I'm going to have a commentary from Professor Gabriel Rockhill, a Franco-American philosopher and cultural critic. I'm also going to have John Whitehead talking about John Lennon's most radical message. And I knew John Lennon. I remember the first time I got a call from him and also a letter asking for some insights and information. And he was a flawed person in many ways, but he was also unique and revolutionary and fearless in other ways. And in judging anyone, we have to look at the sum total of all that they did that was constructive or what they did that was less than constructive. And I will do that in the discussion of John Lennon because I think it's time after all these years to go back and look at some of his very radicalized messages. And he had a forum, and that forum was his celebrity status, and he put it into his music, much as some performers do today. So we're going to hear about what did John Lennon really stand for, and when he was being radical, was America paying attention? I'll tell you who was paying attention, the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. Also today, if time permits, a short clip on our supposed democracy and its failings by Chris Hedges. And we're going to take a look at, from a person who was a top executive at Facebook, what has happened in his world to let him see now what kind of monster he created. So he'll give us his perspective and you'll hear from that. And then I'll share some commentary on that afterwards. I'm not having a guest today, so I can leave time in the latter part of the program for talk back and your opportunity to share your thoughts. We always start with health and healing. Drinking a cup of hot tea at least once a day is linked with a significantly lower risk of developing serious eye conditions like glaucoma. And that's a study published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology. And I'm assuming that if they did this with green tea or black tea or oolong tea, it would show the positive effects. We already know that green tea can help prevent cancer, can help turn off inflammation in the body. It's just that I'm not suggesting anyone drink any tea unless they get the decaffeinated type. Also, dietary combination transforms lethal breast cancers into highly treatable ones. This is in the University of Alabama. And what happened there was researchers at the university have found that a dietary combination helps transform the most lethal of all breast cancers into highly treatable breast cancer. Specifically, scientists involved in the Scientific Reports study says that a plant-based diet is the key. That is so positive. That is so important. Let us remember this. All breast cancers are either estrogen receptor positive or estrogen receptor negative. The tumors in estrogen receptor negative breast cancer are much less likely to respond to hormone therapy than are tumors that are positive, which means that the estrogen receptor negative breast cancers are very aggressive. They're the big killers. This is from the study. Unfortunately, there are few options for women who develop the negative breast cancer. Because of the poor prognosis, this type of breast cancer carries new advances in prevention and treatment from the estrogen negative breast cancers have particular significance. Well, with that in mind, they set out to further research how scientists can efficiently neutralize mechanisms that lead to or worsening of the negative cancers. And up till this time, orthodox cancer prevention has focused primarily on single chemotherapy compounds. And here they found that when you put a person on a plant-based diet, it makes an enormous difference. In effect, it successfully turned on a gene in the negative breast cancer so that the cancer could be treated in a more effective way. Now, I think that's very positive because up till now they have not recognized the combination of dietary plant-derived compounds like sulforaphane from cruciferous vegetables such as broccoli sprouts, along with polyphenols from green tea, what I just mentioned, in successfully preventing and treating the estrogen receptive negative breast cancer. And yet those of us in the health field have been using a plant-based diet very high in indole-3 carbonyl and isothiocyanates and all these chemicals that are in mustard, radishes, bok choy, broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus, Brussels sprouts, kale, watercress. Those are all terrific. So hopefully they'll get around to that. From a German Research Center for Environmental Health, published in the journal Nutrients, they found that one in two persons 65 and older has a suboptimal levels of vitamin D in their blood. And had they also looked, they would have found that we are also suboptimal in our society in vitamin B12, in vitamin C, in vitamin E, and zinc, and magnesium. So what this is saying, this study, is that they've been doing research for 30 years on thousands of people living in southern Germany. And the aim of the study is to understand the impact of environmental factors and lifestyle factors and genes on health. And now they're finally acknowledging iron, folate, B12, vitamin D. Yeah, those are all deficient in half the population. So what we suggest is in a really healthy plant-based diet, which they do not have in Germany. In fact, of all my travels around the world, and I've been to Germany many times, I find that the German diet is one of the worst. The worst diet I've ever found in the world for a developed country is England, United Kingdom. Scotland is right behind that. Ireland's close behind that. And heavy on dairy, heavy on fatty meats, lots of sugar, the dental decay, the mouth infections, gingivitis, periodontal conditions is epidemic in these countries, as is being obese. And you get these ruddy complexions that you see on people, not healthy, you know, very blemished, lots of blemishes and pimples and rashes and skin conditions. And you go into the restaurants and you see that. I remember when I took my daughter to Great Britain as a birthday present, and she wanted to go to some restaurants. And I said, fine. And I looked at the menu. I said, Shelley, there's nothing here to eat. So I ended up going to Neil's Yard and buying organic produce, taking it back to the hotel and making meals there myself, because I'm a gourmet chef, so I can make a better meal in any restaurant I could eat at. But she was disappointed because the whole ambiance, because there are beautiful ambiances and nice service, it's just the food's crappy. And very salty and deep fried fish and chips, colas, not good. Where you go to a country like Spain, France, you can't get a bad meal in France. In fact, one of the best meals I ever had cost me $10. And it wasn't a big fancy restaurant. It was close to where I was staying, which is a couple blocks from the Eiffel Tower. And it was just on a side street, and I went in one afternoon. And I said, do you have anything for vegans? And he just smiled. I said, of course we do. I said, could you make something up for me? And he says, of course. So I went outside and I sat, and it was a nice day. And about a half hour later, he comes out and says, it's ready. And I come in, and I couldn't believe it. It was the plate was as large as a pizza plate, and it was stacked with about 15 different types of vegetables, some sauteed like eggplant and zucchinis. There was a whole grain in the middle, sauces around it. It was like a crown of vegetables. It reminded me of the old Fertile Earth restaurant, the first gourmet vegan restaurant in American history. That's what I started up as a cooperative. I started. You get a whole meal for $2.50, 108th and Broadway. It was so much fun. I'm sure there's someone listening now that at one time ate there. And I would make a crown of vegetables on a plate. It wasn't as big as what I got, but it was delicious with different sauces coming down each side of it. $10 is what he charged me. I was just flabbergasted. But that's so common. So you want phenomenal food. You can get that in Italy with great charm, in France, in Spain, Portugal, and then you got Germany. I remember I was over there investigating the live cell therapy that Dr. Klaus Martin at his clinic had. And I was impressed with the results that I saw. But the food, he stopped as we were driving from a clinic over to this village, small, very popular. And you went in and you sat at a table, and it was like a community table. And in the middle was this turntable. And it had a whole bunch of different pickles and different types of sauerkrauts, but it had all these different types of sausages. And the bad part was that there was a room at the back where they were doing all the dressing of these sausages, these pigs back there. And being an animal rights activist and a vegan, that didn't go well with me, but I was not there to make a scene and embarrass my host. I said, I'll pass on all this, thank you, and left the place. And so I asked the guy, I said, that's an awful lot of food to be eating before you get home. Now, they ate before they went home to eat dinner. And I said, I'm looking at probably 1,000 calories that I saw people at every table eating. They're just wolfing down those sausages like crazy. Yeah, well, that's the tradition. But then you see these very stocky people, generally overweight. Now, I'm not sure that younger people are doing that today, because a whole new younger generation are bringing with them far more radical ideas in all these countries about a healthier diet, living foods, even restaurants now that grow the food on the roof, beautiful sun gardens, and serve it downstairs. I believe there's one even in Brooklyn. I haven't been there, but I heard someone mention it. That's the future, by the way. So that's good. In any case, another study talks about soy and cruciferous vegetables associated with fewer common breast cancer treatment side effects. And this is from Georgetown University Medical Center. And it's about consuming either soy milk or tofu or edamame, which is very tasty, non-GMO, organic, I'm talking about, and other cruciferous vegetables, cabbage, kale, the ones I just mentioned, collard greens, bok choy, Brussels sprouts, and broccoli. And that has been able to reduce the side effects of breast cancer treatment in survivors. This is a different study published in Breast Cancer Research and Treatment. And what it says very simply is this: a higher intake in cruciferous vegetables and soy foods were associated with fewer reports of menopausal symptoms. And higher soy intake was also associated with less reported fatigue. And breast cancer survivors, including 173 non-Hispanic white and 192 Chinese Americans, were involved in the study. So what do we learn? We learn that researchers say breast cancer survivors often experience side effects. Anyone who's had chemotherapy and radiation knows how extreme that can be. And that's from the treatment. And those can persist for months, even years, after completion of treatment. For example, because many treatments designed to prevent breast cancer reoccurrence inhibit the body's production or use of estrogen, the hormone that can fuel breast cancer growth, which is estrogen. If you're overweight, you're getting more estrogen. If you're eating meat, more estrogen. If you're stressed, more estrogen. So breast cancer patients often experience hot flashes and night sweats because they have a hormone imbalance. And with this, that is substantially obviated. It's reduced. So soy and cruciferous to help you overcome that. And finally, the omega-3 fatty acids. And you can get that from avocados and walnuts and flaxseed and hemp seed. You can also get it from fish. But according to Laval University in Quebec, it helps prevent neurodegenerative diseases. And that's very important. Quote, as the prevalence of neurodegenerative diseases increases steadily, the need to develop new treatment approaches intensifies, and the possibility of targeting risk of and protective factors to delay onset of these diseases is attracting more interest. And then it went into what to do specifically about modifying the health risks of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And they found that the omega-3 fatty acids made the difference. Big difference. So I'm suggesting that the people in this audience take your omega-3s every day to have healthier brains. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment with more. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Now to our environmental segment. According to Climate News Network and Tim Radford, extreme storms are going to be multiplying and intensifying right now and going forward in the United States. Here's what he said. For the U.S., harder rain is on the way. America's summer thunderstorms are about to get stormier. Later this century, the notorious mesoscale convection storms of middle America will not just get darker skies, they will dump as much as 80% more water on the farms and highways and cities of all the states. The combination of more intense rainfall and the spreading of heavy rainfall over large areas means that we will face a higher flood risk than previously predicted. Wow, and that's from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. So in lay language, what this means is that this year we only spent $20 billion in flash floods and landslides and debris flows, high winds. That's going to go way up. And if you thought it was heavy rain in the past, now the new norm is heavy rain everywhere, heavier storms. And these storms will be about 65 miles across. That's a big storm. Now from Cornell University comes this. Climate scientists studied the odds of a U.S. mega drought. This was published in the Journal of Climate. And they're looking at a drought that can last over 40 years. And right now, it looks like that these mega droughts, 30 to 40 years without any rain or barely any rain, are going to be happening. So where are you most likely to see these droughts? Texas, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Kansas, Indiana, Idaho, Colorado. These are the areas that are going to be severely hit. So that's something to consider. And that means that the plants that are growing there, when the ground is too hot and the seeds won't germinate, you're not going to have a breadbasket in the future as we've had a breadbasket in the past. Also, the largest aquifer in the United States, the Algalago Aquifer, underneath seven states, is going down so far because it's not being recharged. Far more water is being brought out every day by the cities and agriculture and industry than what's recharging it. So that's drying up also. So pay attention. Water is going to be the big issue now and going forward. And to give you an idea, right now, we're heard all over the world. So most people right now could go in and turn on the water and take a shower, however long you wanted to, or however much water your hot water tank held. You could water your lawn, wash your car. And for most people, that's not an issue. It's going to be, mark my words, it's going to be, water is real important. And just this one state, I only did one state as an example, we actually reached out and did the statistical analysis for Texas and found over 1,200 communities, and one of those communities is Houston, were running out of water and having to divert water from other sources and use other aquifers because too many people, too many uses, too little water, and it's going to get a lot worse. Climate change, according to Rice University, made Harvey rainfall 15% more intense. So a team of scientists from World Weather Attribution, including researchers from Rice University and other institutions, have found that human-caused climate change made the record rainfall that fell on Houston during Hurricane Harvey roughly 300% more likely than previously. So you're getting more rain, far more rain. How much rain? Well, according to the research I was using, in Harvey, 20 trillion gallons. 20 trillion gallons. That's just horrific. And what is the most overlooked environmental crisis in the United States? Well, according to Emily Atkin of New Republic, it's off the coast of Louisiana. So I went down to the coast of Louisiana and took a look. And there it is. 8,000 square mile swath of ocean. The marine life is suffocating to death. Why? Nutrient pollution. Flowing from the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico, It's birthing huge clumps of algae that are sucking oxygen from the water. And without oxygen, fish are struggling to respirate and fleeing the scene in mass. And plants and worms, being unable to flee, are washed away and die. This so-called dead zone, you've heard me talk about it many times in the Gulf, has been appearing every spring and lasting until the winter since monitoring began in 1985. But this year, it grew to the size of New Jersey, the largest dead zone ever recorded in the world. How's that happening? Because we're doing monoagriculture. We're growing single crops using pesticides, artificial fertilizers. We're not doing cover crop in the spring or winter. As a result, you've got naked soil. It freezes, the snows come, then the rains come in the spring, and it washes all that topsoil and all that fertilizer into the water, and down it goes. So that's what's happening. So what's the solution? It's relatively simple. The American public, stop buying anything but organic and preferably locally grown produce, because that is sustainable. And that's what we want. And that preserves the land, preserves the soil, and stops the dead zones from accumulating all over the place. Now, to the person last night, one of the most steadfast beliefs regarding the United States is that it is a democracy. Whenever this conviction wavers slightly, it's almost always to point out detrimental exceptions to core American values or foundational principles. For instance, aspiring critics frequently bemoan a loss of democracy due to the election of clownish autocrats and draconian measures on the part of the state, the revelation of extraordinary malfeasance or deadly corruption, or deadly foreign interventions, or some other such activities that are considered undemocratic exceptions. The same is true for those whose critical framework consists in always juxtaposing the actions of the United States government to its founding principles, highlighting the contradiction between the two, and clearly placing hope in its potential resolution. Here's the problem. There is no contradiction or supposed loss of democracy, because the United States simply never was a democracy. This is a difficult reality for many people to confront, and they are likely more inclined to immediately dismiss such claim as preposterous rather than take the time to scrutinize the material historical record in order to see for themselves. Such a dismissive reaction is due in large part to what is perhaps the most successful public relations campaign in modern history, and what will seem, however, if this record is soberly and methodically inspected, is that a country founded on elite colonial rule based on the power of wealth, a plutocratic colonial oligarchy, in short, has succeeded not only in buying the label of democracy to market itself to the masses, but in having its citizenry and many others so socially and psychologically invested in its nationalistic origin myth that they refuse to hear lucid and well-documented arguments to the contrary. So let's begin to peel the scales from our eyes. Let us outline, in this restricted time that we have here, five patent reasons why the United States has never been a democracy. And to begin with, British colonial expansion into the Americas did not occur in the name of the freedom and equality of the general population or the conferral of power to the people. Those who settled on the shores of the New World, with few exceptions, did not respect the fact that it was a very old world indeed, and that a vast indigenous population had been living here for centuries. As soon as Columbus set foot, Europeans began robbing and enslaving and killing the native inhabitants. The transatlantic slave trade commenced almost immediately thereafter, adding a countless number of Africans to the ongoing genocidal assault against the indigenous population. Moreover, It is estimated that over half the colonists who came to North America from Europe during the colonial period were poor indentured servants, and women were generally trapped in roles of domestic servitude. So rather than the land of the free and the equal, then, European colonial expansion to the Americas imposed a land of the colonizer and the colonized, the master and the slave, the rich and the poor, the free and the unfree. The former constituted, moreover, an infinitesimally small minority of the population, whereas the overwhelming majority, meaning the people, was subjected to death, slavery, servitude, and unremitting socioeconomic oppression. Second, when the elite colonial ruling class decided to sever ties with their homeland and establish an independent state for themselves, they did not found it as a democracy. On the contrary, they were fervently and explicitly opposed to democracy, like the vast majority of European Enlightenment thinkers. They understood it to be a dangerous and chaotic form of uneducated mob rule. For the so-called founding fathers, the masses were not only incapable of ruling, but they were considered a threat to the hierarchical social structures purportedly necessary for good governance. In the words of John Adams, who would become president, to take but one telling example, if the majority were given real power, they would redistribute wealth and dissolve the subordination so necessary for politics. When the eminent members of the land-owning class met in 1787 to draw up a constitution, they regularly insisted in their debates on the need to establish a republic. It's a republic that would keep at bay vile democracy, which was judged worse than the filth of the common sewers, they said. That was a pro-federalist editor, William Cobbett. So the new constitution provided for popular elections only in the House of Representatives, but in most states the right to vote was based upon being a property owner. So a woman, indigenous inhabitants, and slaves, meaning the overwhelming majority of the population, were simply excluded from the franchise. Senators were elected by state legislators, not the citizens. The president by electors chosen by the state legislators, not the citizens, and the Supreme Court was appointed by the president. It is in this context that Patrick Henry flatly proclaimed the most lucid of judgments. He said, "It is not a democracy." And George Mason further clarified the situation by describing the newly independent country as a despotic aristocracy. So when the American Republic slowly came to be relabeled as a democracy, there was no significant institutional modification to justify the change in name. In other words, and this is the third point, the use of the term democracy to refer to an oligarchical republic simply meant that a different word was being used to describe the same basic phenomena. This began around the time of the Indian killer Andrew Jackson's presidential campaign in the 1830s. Presenting himself as a Democrat, he put forth an image of himself as an average man of the people who was going to put a halt to the long reign of patricians from Virginia and Massachusetts. So slowly but surely, the term democracy came to be used as a public relations term to rebrand a plutocratic oligarchy as an electoral regime that serves the interests of the people, or demos. Meanwhile, the American Holocaust continued unabated, along with the chattel slavery, colonial expansion, and top-down class warfare. So in spite of certain minor changes over time, the U.S. Republic has doggedly preserved its oligarchical structure, and this is readily apparent in the two major selling points of its contemporary democratic publicity campaign. The establishment's protagonist regularly insists that a structural aristocracy is a democracy because the latter is defined by a guarantee of certain fundamental rights. That's the legal definition. And the holding of regular elections. That's the procedural definition. This is, of course, a purely formal, abstract, and largely negative understanding of democracy, which says nothing whatsoever about people having real and sustained power over the growing interest in the government of controlling our lives. And if you don't think that the government has excessive control over your life, don't pay your property taxes and see who owns your house. Don't register your car and see who owns your car. Don't get a marriage certificate and see how legally binding your marriage is. We are inundated in a swamp of bureaucracy, and we've adapted to it. We've adapted to a moronic, supercilious, completely fraudulent two-party system, the lesser of two evils. And that's all we've had for a long time, are evils. But these are our oligarchs. These are forebears and descendants and the people who bear up the nationalistic creed that we are democracy. No, we are not, never have been. So this is all hollow definition, and it dissimulates the extent to which, to begin with, the supposed equality before the law in the United States presupposes an inequality before the law by excluding major sections of the population, those judged not to have the right to rights, and those considered to have lost their rights to rights, Native Americans, African American, women for most of the country's history, and still today in certain aspects, many immigrants, the people incarcerated, minors, those judged mentally incompetent, political dissenters. So regarding elections, they are run in the United States as long multi-million, multi-billion dollar advertising campaigns in which the candidates and issues are pre-selected by the corporate and party elite. The general population, the majority of whom do not have the right to vote or decide not to exercise it, are given this so-called choice, overseen by an undemocratic electoral college, a completely fraudulent group of nincompoops, and embedded in a non-proportional representation scheme regarding which member of the aristocratic elite they would like to have rule over and oppress them for the next 2 years, 4 years, 6 years. So what you're dealing with is multivariate and not democratic. To take but a final example of the myriad ways in which the United States is not and has never been a democracy, it is worth highlighting its consistent assault on the movements of people who are wanting power. Since World War II, it has endeavored to overthrow some 50 foreign governments, most of which were democratically elected. It is also, according to the meticulous calculations of William Blum in America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, grossly interfered in the elections of over 30 countries, attempting to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders, dropping bombs on more than 30 countries, and attempted to suppress populist movements in 20 more countries. So the record on the home front is just as brutal. To take but one significant parallel example, there is ample evidence that the FBI has been invested in covert war against democracy, beginning at least in the 1960s and likely continuing up to the present. The Bureau, quote, extended its earlier clandestine operations against the Communist Party, committing its resources to undermining the Puerto Rican independent movement, the Socialist Workers' Party, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Nationalist Movement, the Ku Klux Klan, segments of the peace movement, the student movement, and the New Left in general. That's according to COINTELPRO, the FBI's secret war on political freedom. So consider, for example, Judy Berry's summary of its assault on the Socialist Party. Quote, from 1943 to 1963, the federal civil rights case, Socialist Workers Party versus Attorney General, documents decades of illegal FBI break-ins and 10 million pages of surveillance records. The FBI paid an estimated 1,600 informants and used 20,000 days of wiretaps to undermine legitimate political organizing, end quote. In the case of the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement, which were both important attempts to mobilize people power to dismantle the structural oppression of white supremacy and top-down class warfare, the FBI not only infiltrated them and launched hideous smear and destabilization campaigns against them, but they assassinated 27 Black Panthers and 69 members of the American Indian Movement, and incarcerated millions more. If it is to be understood, we have been a criminal country before, during, and after all these election cycles. The American Secret Police has been extremely proactive in beating down the movements of people rising up, thereby protecting and preserving the main pillars of white supremacy, which is, quite simply, with capital letters, capitalist aristocracy. And rather than blindly believing in a golden age of democracy in order to remain at all costs within the gilded cage of an ideology produced specifically for us by the well-paid spinmeisters of the plutocratic oligarchy, we should unlock the gates of history and meticulously scrutinize the founding and evolution of the American Imperial Republic. And that will not only allow us to take leave of self-congratulatory original myths, but it will also provide us with the opportunity to resuscitate and reactivate so much of what they have sought to obliterate. In particular, there's a radical movement in America that is surfacing slowly, but it is. The nationalist narratives, an American in which the popularity of autonomous organizations such as indigenous and ecological activism, and black radical resistance and anti-capitalist motivation and anti-patriarchal struggles are moving forward. It is this America that the corporate republic has sought to eradicate while simultaneously investing in an expansive public relations campaign to cover over its crimes with a fig leaf of democracy. If we are astute and insightful enough to recognize that the U.S. is undemocratic today, let us not be so indolent or ill-informed that we let ourselves be lulled to sleep by lullabies praising a halcyon past. Indeed, if the United States is not a democracy today, it is in large part due to the fact that it never has been one. Far from being a pessimistic conclusion, however, it is precisely by cracking open the hard shell of ideological encasement that we can tap into the radical forces that have been suppressed by it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. With us today on Monday's program at noon over all of our sister stations, I'll be doing a really in-depth review of the world, the planet, and saving ourselves. I received an email from Les Jameson, and he said, Gary, if you have a chance in the coming days to give a quick heads up on this, here's some copy. And it talks about that the warrantless, they're trying to legalize warrantless spying, and we need to be ahead of this, and we need to say no to the reauthorization of the National Defense Authorization Act. We need to go to a website to get more information. So let us seize the opportunity to raise a wider awareness of the reality of 9/11 and its continued relevance. And this will involve organizing so as to inform members of Congress and pressure them to take a stand against the illegal power of the security state. The details are at hr14.org, hr14.org, hr14.org. It's coming up, less than a week, premiering Deadly Deception, a limited private showing for the people who really want to see a powerful film. It took about 3 years to write, direct, produce it, edit it, and get it ready for you. Worldwide, for all the people all over the world in California and other places, there'll be a worldwide premiere in January for you, plus a webinar, plus people leading some of the movement who will be on board during that. That'll be historic. This one is a small one. It's next week. It's next Thursday. If you'd like to join me to watch this, simply call my office at 646-926-5000. 5422-646-926-5422. Or you can go to prn.fm, PRN, that's Progressive Radio Network, prn.fm. Or you can call the box office, 212-864-5400, 212-864-5400. I do not have the capacity today to take talkback calls. Sorry, hopefully our new equipment will be in next week. A whole new state-of-the-art phone system which modulates your voice so it sounds like you're sitting in a microphone, and that'll allow all the people to call in and be able to be heard clearly, and that's good. I want to share something about John Lennon, something you may not remember. Here's what John Lennon said in 1969. You got to remember, establishment, it's just a name for evil. The monster doesn't care whether it kills all the students or whether there's a revolution. It's not thinking logically. It's out of control. Militant, nonviolent resistance works. Peaceful, prolonged protest work. Mass movements with huge numbers of participants work. Yes, America, it is possible to use occupations and civil disobedience to oppose government policies and counter injustice and bring about change outside the confines of the ballot box. It has been done before. It can be done again. I'm one of those individuals who loves history. I know many of you do as well. For example, a historical lesson. In May of 1932, more than 43,000 people, dubbed the Bonus Army, these were World War I veterans and their families, marched on Washington. They were out of work. They were destitute. They had families to feed. And more than 10,000 veterans set up tent cities in the nation's capital, and they refused to leave until the government agreed to pay them the bonuses they had been promised as a reward for their services. The Senate voted against paying them immediately, but the protesters didn't budge. Congress adjourned for the summer, and still the protesters remained encamped. Finally, on July 28th, under the orders of President Herbert Hoover, the military descended with tanks and cavalry and drove the protesters out, setting their makeshift camps on fire. Still, the protesters returned the following year, and eventually their efforts not only succeeded in securing payment of the bonuses, but contributed to the passage of the GI Bill of Rights. Similarly, the civil rights movement mobilized hundreds of thousands of people to strike at the core of an unjust and discriminatory society. Likewise, while the 1960s anti-war movement began with a few thousand perceived radicals, it ended with hundreds of thousands of protesters spanning all walks of life and demanding the end of American military aggression abroad. This kind of power-to-the-people activism, grassroots, populist, and potent, is exactly the brand of civil engagement John Lennon advocated throughout his career as a musician and an anti-war activist. It's been 37 years since Lennon was gunned down by an assassin's bullet on December 8, 1980. But his legacy and the lessons he imparted in his music and his activism have not diminished over the years. All the many complaints we have about government today, surveillance and corruption, harassment, political persecution and spying, overcriminalization, were used against John Lennon. But that didn't deter him. In fact, it formed the basis of his call for social justice and peace in a populist revolution. Little wonder, then, that the United States government saw him as an enemy number one. And because he never refrained from speaking truth to power, Lennon became a prime example of the lengths to which the U.S. government will go to persecute those who dare to challenge its authority. Lennon was the subject of a four-year campaign of surveillance and harassment by the U.S. government, spearheaded by the FBI director's completely insane J. Edgar Hoover, in an attempt by President Richard Nixon to have him neutralized and deported. And as Adam Cohen of the New York Times put it, the FBI surveillance of Lennon is a reminder of how easily domestic spying can become unmoored from its legitimate law enforcement purpose. What's more surprising and ultimately more unsettling is the degree to which the surveillance turns out to have been intertwined with electoral politics. Years after Lennon's assassination, it would be revealed that the FBI had collected 281 pages of surveillance files on him. And as the New York Times notes, quote, critics of today's domestic surveillance object largely on privacy grounds. They have focused far less on how easily government surveillance can become an instrument for the people in power to try to hold on to power. The U.S. versus John Lennon is the story not only of one man being harassed, but of a democracy being undermined. While such government-directed harassment was nothing new, the FBI has a long history of persecuting, prosecuting, and generally harassing activists and politicians and cultural figures, and most notably among the latter such celebrated names as folk singer Pete Seeger, painter Pablo Picasso, comic and actor filmmaker Charlie Chaplin, comedian Lenny Bruce, and poet Allen Ginsberg. And among those most closely watched by the FBI were Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and in Lennon's case, the ex-Beatle had learned early on that rock music could serve as a political end by proclaiming a radical message. And more importantly, Lennon saw that his music could mobilize the public and help to bring about change. For instance, in 1971, at a concert in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Lennon took to the stage and in his usual confrontational style belted out John Sinclair. That was a song he had written about a man sentenced to 10 years in prison for possessing two marijuana cigarettes. Two joints. That was it. Within days of Lennon's call for action, the Michigan Supreme Court ordered Sinclair released. And while Lennon believed in the power of the people, he also understood the danger of a power-hungry government. He said, the trouble with government as it is that it doesn't represent the people. It controls them. So by March 1971, when his Power to the People single was released, it was clear where Lennon stood. The release of Lennon's Sometime in New York City album, which contained a radical anti-government message, is virtually every song that depicted President Richard Nixon and Chinese Chairman Mao Zedong dancing together nude on the cover, only fanned the flames of the government agents who had already targeted Lennon. However, the official U.S. war against Lennon began in earnest in 1972 after rumors surfaced that Lennon planned to embark on a U.S. concert tour that would combine rock music with anti-war organizing and voter registration. Nixon, fearing Lennon's influence on about 11 million new voters, 1972 was the first year that 18-year-olds could vote, had the ex-Beatles served with deportation orders. As Lennon's FBI file shows, memos and reports about the FBI surveillance of the anti-war activists have been flying back and forth between Hoover and Nixon's White House and various senators and the FBI's immigration connections. Nixon's pursuit of Lennon was relentless and misplaced. And despite the fact that Lennon was not plotting to bring down the Nixon administration, as the government feared, the government persisted in its efforts to have him deported. Equally determined to resist, Lennon dug in and fought back, and every time he was ordered out of the country, his lawyers delayed the process by filing an appeal. And finally, in 1976, Lennon won the battle to stay in the country, and by 1980, he had reemerged with a new album and plans to become politically active again. The old radical was back and ready to cause trouble. Unfortunately, Lennon's time as a troublemaker was short-lived. I'm Gary Nall. We have people in our society. We've been blessed by having people who stand up for us, who speak our truths, who are not afraid of the consequences. And there will always be consequences. When you go up against the powerful and the mighty, they have unlimited resources. They own the media. They own the judicial system. They own the courts in total. They own the legislative process. They own the educational institutions. And if you doubt me, when was the last time the professors and instructors and the adjuncts and all got together with the students and went on general strike until all student debt is forgiven? To the contrary, no one goes on strike for anything today. And we could and we should, but we won't because we're not in enough pain. Our day of pain reckoning will come, but it'll be too late when it finally occurs to us that we do have a right over the government, and the government should not have the rights over us. And by that time, most people will be so comfortably ensconced in designer cells with flat-screen TVs and lots of distractions and reality headsets and all the gadgets that they can be given that they'll forget that they're in a prison cell until the prison itself collapses and the debris is around them, and they'll say, "What just happened?" Then we'll see how much pain it takes for a society to stand up and say no more. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.